Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 7th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Cliff Schechter to look back at the week that was, and in fact, the past 16 hours. Also, of course, Donald Trump launches 60 cruise missiles attacking the Syrian regime after giving them a warning. So, Daddy went boom boom. And that's about it. $60, $70 million that could have gone somewhere else. Burned up. Meanwhile, in the Senate, in the wake of the Republicans causing the moon to fall into Lake Michigan, as they say, having exercised the nuclear option, have now confirmed, despite a Democratic filibuster, Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, in the White House, it's Bannon v. Kushner. And already, they have taken to the walls.
I'm going to text Joe Scarborough.
It is pretty amazing.
I don't want him on the council anymore.
Meanwhile, Republicans panicking over a Kansas special election happening this Tuesday. Of course, we are a week or so away, 2 weeks away from a special election in Georgia, one in Montana. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We were hoping to have Andy Kindler, but apparently he's doing some special podcast in Indiana, and we couldn't get him.
Weak stuff, amen.
Last night, and we had spoken about this yesterday, of course, there was Donald Trump had claimed that he had had an epiphany upon seeing the video of children who were amongst the dead from a chemical attack. And we should say, let me just start with this, okay? Because we do have members of our audience who are quite convinced that this was ginned up or some type of false flag or whatnot. Obviously, sitting in Brooklyn, New York, one can never know the actual reality of just about anything. I question things that I see right here in this office, frankly, and I'm not quite sure what happens. But with that said, the Guardian paper online was the first Western media organization to visit the site of the attack. They visited and examined the warehouse and silos directly to near where the missile had landed and found nothing, according to them, but an abandoned space covered in dust and half-destroyed silos, reeking of leftover grain and animal manure. Residents said the silos had been damaged in air raids 6 months ago and had stood unused since then. That's relevant because the Russian government claimed that a missile hit a store of sarin gas. So that is off the table. They go on to write, there was no contamination zone near any building. Instead, the contamination area radiated from a hole in a road. They have a picture of that hole. Witnesses said air raids began shortly after 6:30 a.m. on Tuesday with four bombings around town. Initially, they thought it was just another airstrike until the first responders who arrived at the scene began falling to the ground. So it's quite clear that this was perpetrated by the Syrian government. Whether it was some type of rogue mission for whatever reason, I guess we could never know that. However, it's quite clear that the Syrians still had some supplies of chemical agent. In addition, as Michael pointed out, there have been multiple attacks that involve chlorine bombs just in the past month. Last night, I went in to do Chris Hayes' program, ostensibly to talk about the Bannon-Kushner fight. By the time I got there at 8 p.m., the news that there may be, we were operating under the belief that this was still being debated at that time. Obviously, in retrospect, since the attack was reported literally moments after 9 p.m., the decision had already been made. But I ended up going on the program for about 40 minutes on a panel that included the right-wing columnist from the Washington Post, I believe, Jennifer Rubin, who was a never-Trumper, but a very anti-Obama, like dramatically pro-Mitt Romney, right-wing Republican.
And a Rubio fan.
And was he a Rubio fan? Okay. And also a guy from the Brookings Institute. Who was that again?
I think it's Shadi Ahmed.
And Politico reporter Ken Fogle. That panel essentially followed a couple of other of people that Hayes had interviewed. And the range of debate, excluding myself, ranged from we need to do this, and then there has to be, though, there has to be a very well-developed strategy as to where to go forward with this. And ranging from that to we need to do this, and as long as it's part of a larger comprehensive strategy.
By definition, not.
Well, and so, you know, I mean, frankly, to have the opportunity to go into a situation like that and be the lone dissenter is really, like for me, the payoff of doing this for an extended period of time. I mean, over the past couple of years, I've been an official MSNBC contributor, so I've gotten paid, not the big contributor bucks, but the, okay, well.
Thank you for your time.
Yes. Yeah. And so the money has never been the sort of the driving force, although, you know, a couple $100 is not insignificant to me. But to have the opportunity to go on and argue this, and it was a very eerie situation because the guy from the Brookings Institute supposedly is, you know, sort of a left of center person. And the idea that they could all describe, and I made the point that I thought, you know, Cliff and I will talk about this, but that I made the point that, you know, this is a president whose ratings are at 36% approval ratings, and this is an opportunity for him. And the idea that somehow, literally weeks after where he ordered a strike that killed eight children, one of whom was an American citizen. And days after a strike that killed 200 civilians, undoubtedly dozens of them children, in Mosul, that he was so moved by these images that he did a perfect 180 degree on his policy stated days before.
Regarding Henry foreign policy.
Which, yeah, exactly. Which now, in retrospect, looks like the impetus for Assad to see if he could get away with chemical warfare. And the idea that this guy, you know, was doing this because of a genuine, thoughtful change of heart of policy was absurd. And you're arguing that this guy, who they then go on to say, you know, to defend that comment, they would say, well, this is the way he reacts. He reacts viscerally. He watched this on TV. It's perfectly believable that he changed, that had a change of heart. And I said, well, then this is the guy who watches 2 minutes of television, forgets of his involvement in the killing of children weeks later or earlier, and then decides on a dime that he's going to change policy 180 degrees. That's the guy who's going to come up with a very careful strategy on where this goes next. I mean, these two things are not reconcilable. And you'll recall the perhaps the linchpin of why we went to war in 2003 with such broad-based support, American support, was people like Thomas Friedman, who had this notion of how everything could work out magically in Iraq, but then later said, but of course, those guys, my mistake was trusting George Bush. At the time, I thought he could execute this. Even if there were an argument that you need to just basically launch missiles into some Syrian desert to show that you're willing to do that to maintain the norms of chemical warfare, as if that warfare was somehow more lethal than the warfare that created 500,000 deaths in that civil war at this point. But even if you thought that, the idea to make an argument that it needs to be followed up with some careful strategic thinking and that it's going to be executed by the universally accepted single most incompetent person to ever sit in that office is to say that careful strategic thinking means nothing and has no implications. Anyways, I got a lot of time to express those opinions over the course of those 40 minutes. As far as I could tell, the rest of the evening went as, you know, one could expect if one lived through the buildup to the Iraq War, which is the moment the idea of military action is introduced. People divide into, I guess, like three camps. One is saying there hasn't been proper process followed. That's the only dissent you hear. Two, we're just going to report this as if this is a fait accompli and bring on a series of experts who explain why this is necessary. And then into just full-on war porn, where everybody likes to, where they bring on experts who introduce us to new terms that we never heard before. And then we all have sort of some type of group masturbatory celebration over the sheer power that emanates either from our ships, our missiles, those who ordered it. On and on. So and all of which totally predictable from every network. I mean, you know, people should not be surprised about this. Comcast owns 51% of NBC, but the other 49%, maybe I'm getting the specific numbers, but wrong. The other 49% is made by one of the largest weapons manufacturers in the world. And frankly, there's not a lot of incentive for people to go on to these programs. I mean, and dissent from the idea of bombing people. The incentive structure is set up in such a way. I mean, like, you can come on, and if you are from an advocacy group, maybe sometimes they bring those people on. And I think on MSNBC, they did have one or two people like that later in the evening, is my understanding. But there's just not going to be many pundits who are going to do this. And frankly, one of the reasons, really, I wouldn't go on and do it in a different context. But frankly, the having this show be the reason why I do that stuff versus that stuff being the reason why I do that stuff sets me up with a completely different incentive structure. I don't care. And frankly, I think on Hayes' show, I'm there to do that. I think at 12 o'clock at night, he went back on, and I think they replayed some of the stuff I said because, there's nobody else around to come in and do that. They're not going to screw up their, career trajectory. Fortunately, mine is, my trajectory is leveled off, has trajected already. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break and get on the phone with Cliff Schechter, see what he thinks about this. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone is a person who inspired all sorts of ditties, but this is one of them.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Hello, Cliff. What's old is new again, hmm?
Yeah, I've just sort of, I don't know, I've lost all my bearings. Where are we? What year is it? What the hell's going on? I think this is what totalitarian governments are supposed to do, right? I mean, there just gets to be a certain point you don't even know what the hell's up and what the hell's down anymore, right?
I mean, you know, I have no idea what, you know, this is.
I feel like I can quote former Reaganite Bruce Bartlett, who said on Twitter, "They told me if I voted for Hillary, we'd be at war in Syria in 6 months. They were right. I voted for Hillary and we're at war in Syria in 6 months." Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I mean, I think, you know, look, it's quite possible. I mean, certainly, and let's make no mistake about this. Hillary Clinton was out there yesterday afternoon. I think it was in the afternoon, yeah. Right? And she was advocating the bombing of the Syrian Air Force, which...
Oh, yeah. She came out in favor of bombing, so I'm not letting her off the... Well, I mean, it's not even letting her off the hook versus, you know... I just want to know, you know, after... as somebody who... maybe this makes me naive, you know, because I don't have financial interests in what we do or don't do, but... somebody who believes in good policy and believes in saving people's lives if we can, you know, who thought we should have tried to work with the African Union and others to get involved and prevent the massacre of Rwanda, because I very much do believe when people are being massacred, not that we don't necessarily need to go in and kill more people, but unless it's in self-defense, but we certainly should go in and try to block. You know, if it's a straight-on genocide, we need to do what we can to get in and prevent it. I don't think we should just watch people die. At the same time, like, I don't understand what the point of this was. Trump told Russia, who told Syria, I don't even think anybody was there. It was like kabuki theater. And even so, let's say the bombing was going to target. What I want somebody to tell me after Iraq and Libya, both of which I were against, both of which turned into shit shows as far as I'm concerned, what is the goal? What is it we're trying to accomplish, and what is it we think can be accomplished? I mean, you could argue that there was a successful intervention in Bosnia. Some would say that wasn't our place, or whatever. We can get, you know, people on the left can debate that. But I want to know, like, what is it we think we can accomplish here? Can we save children's lives? How can we do that? Because I don't know any of this stuff. I just feel like we're launching some stuff,
let's take the first part of that, because there are two separate things here, right? Like, what did those bombs accomplish, and what would be the long term strategic goal? Like, can someone articulate? And because this is, you know, I was saying before you came on that I was on Hayes last night, and I had this argument with a guy from Brookings and Jennifer Rubin, and the guy from Brookings, of course, when I rose. I said those points and raised that that dissent. The argument was like, well, if you're one of those people who just want to sit by and do nothing and think that we shouldn't do this, it is incumbent upon you to come up with an answer on how we're going to, you know, what we are going to do. And
it's the exact opposite, actually.
Yes, exactly. Like, it is exactly
the
opposite.
Stuff, it's up to you to explain how that helps.
Yes, exactly. Because there is... The idea, and this is the problem, is that the American psyche cannot accept the idea that, not that we should or shouldn't, forget about shoulds, forget about normative values, that there are some instances where we're not magic, where we cannot supersede the laws of physics, as it were, and actually stop things that we don't have the ability to control. And we simply do not have the ability to enter into this conflict with any reasonable, even remote assurance that we will achieve what our supposed objective is. I mean, this guy was talking about degrading the Assad's forces and enhancing the moderate rebels, which maybe there are, maybe there aren't. I don't know. I honestly
hear about these. But, okay, talk about magic. We always hear about moderate rebels that I never seem to find.
But let's just assume for a moment even that there are moderate rebels. What he's talking about is that supposedly by bringing these two parties to parity, that a guy who is hell-bent and staying in power enough that he would gas his own people is going to then say, like, well, I'll go to the negotiating table and give up some stuff to you, as opposed to this is just simply going to prolong the war. I mean, it's quite clear that everybody involved in this war does not care about the deaths of the people who are fighting for them or who are being caught in the middle. So really, right. The only thing that we can do, the only thing that we can do that will mitigate the suffering, if that's theoretically what is driving us into this, is to provide, and we could, hats off to General McCaffrey, because I saw him on last night, and he was the only one I heard who said anything like this. For $1 billion a month or a week, we could provide safety for the millions of refugees who are at least just outside the country.
See, and this is the crap that gets me really angry, because, again, there used to be a sort of coherence to conservatism. You know what I mean? There used to actually be a philosophy there. It wasn't just like, what's your latest impulse and let's do it, which that's why Trump is like the perfect guy for this age of conservatism. And the conservatism was, don't take on big projects, whether it's providing, you know, jumping into universal health care, that's the way they would say it, at home, or bombing abroad, because you don't know what you might unleash. And it was a philosophy that I actually disagreed with to somewhat, especially on the domestic side, because you don't tend to, when you try to get people health care, blow stuff up by mistake. So it's a little different. But at least there was sort of a sense, you know, some coherence to not make doing things too quickly without them being thought out. And I could accept that. That's a philosophy you can debate depending on, say, well, better case for it when it comes to health care than when it comes to. But this, there's no philosophy here. I mean, Trump a week ago was saying, you know, wouldn't be doing anything there. Tillerson was giving Assad a thumbs up almost. These guys are in bed with the Russians, clearly, who are big backers of Assad. So none of that stuff, you know, makes any sense on any level. And then just the fact that, you know, I mean, it's like, it's hilarious watching people like Sean Hannity try to, you know, erase their tweets now. From 2013, many Republicans, all of whom were like, Ted Cruz, I just can't support this, you know, with my vote in Congress. You can, however, support it if somebody does it without a congressional authorization in a different situation with no strategy, no underlying theory behind what we're doing. Oh, and on top of that, a guy who's an effing moron as president, who's clearly shown he has no character and is still making things up, like people wiretapping him and stuff like that. That's someone you're going to trust? I mean, I know people on the left, these are people, and I would call it the far left, like to have this argument that all wars are equal. They're not, all right? And I'm somebody who's very, very, as I said before, I was against Libya. I was against Iraq. Those were with different presidents of different parties. I tend to be very much against getting involved unless we have something that you can be called a clear strategy. And if it's a clear genocide with, you know, not a civil war per se and other things. But you know, on top of all of that, like, you know, when you try to sort of say everything is equal, it is not. A war, I'm sorry, a war run by Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or, hell, George H.W. Bush, for that matter, i.e. a competent person who cares at least about human life, has shown that they give a crap about something other than, you know, the tall buildings they put up, is a very different animal than trusting Trump to do anything right. I mean, the guy couldn't come home from Florida for the whole thing, right? He had to still be at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, that, you know, like, it's ridiculous. I can't trust Trump to, I mean, we could have even if you gave me the best plan in the world come up, you know, that smart generals came up with, and a clear case of where we could do something, I'm not saying there's no way I would support it, but I'm still hesitant because we have this, you know, ADHD moron, and that's not even fair to people with ADHD. This guy has the attention span of a gnat. You know, running things, who wants to run off and meet with people and charge people more at his damn, you know, Southern White House. That's more important to them than being at the situation and actually monitoring what the hell's going on.
Well, I think just what took place in terms of Syria policy over the course of the past 8 days, to me, is disqualifying enough to suggest that this guy has the ability to formulate and stick to and the discipline to formulate even any type of long-term strategy. I mean, they literally went 180 degrees on their policy within the period of maybe 5 or 6 days. And there is every reason to believe that this chemical attack was a function of Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson saying, we stand down from the posture of just saying that we want regime change, and it's up to, you know, let the chips fall where they may. And I think Assad basically said, oh, great, let's let the chips fall where they may.
The chips don't tend to fall in good places, at least in recent years, when we try to change regimes. You know, argue against the Gulf War, and I can make that argument too, but not changing the regime was a very smart move, most people agreed, and would still agree. I mean, you can't leave a vacuum in power. Guess what? ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whoever, people step into it because people who are desperate and hungry will do desperate things.
But there's but I guess my point is, like, there's also, like, listen, Barack Obama had the policy of we want regime change in Syria. That's our stated policy preference. But
right.
We are not prepared to go in and blow up Syria for that purpose. And Donald Trump, for whatever reason, felt it necessary to move off that policy and did not seem to understand that he was communicating very much like George H. Walker Bush when he sent the ambassador, I think, to Kuwait.
At the time, where he said, yeah, it's okay if Saddam goes
like,
in. It's cool.
You got a green light. Do whatever you want to do.
Well, he thought they were only going to take the northern section of Kuwait I'm not justifying it. I'm just making a point.
Well, but my point
like,
is,
nope,
is that like,
going in everywhere and taking everything and the oil.
These things have, you know, diplomacy turns out to be a fairly nuanced thing, and
you actually have to understand language and be consistent, which is why, which is why most people in foreign policy world, when they heard Trump say, "I'm going to be unpredictable,"
so the
like,
guy
he's like, "Oh my God, unpredictable leads to lots of people dying."
The That's guy who doesn't understand this literally on Monday is not capable on Thursday of creating some type of long-term strategy to that follows up an air attack. So what we end up with is, and you know, frankly, I'd rather this than the alternative is, and the alternative being, you know, frankly, what Hillary Clinton was recommending, which would have been far more aggressive, it seems to me, but missiles shot into the desert as a way of making him feel powerful and just, I think from his perspective, getting those 7 or 8 polling points, approval rating points that he needs to reengage with his legislative agenda.
Right. Right.
I mean, I think...
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, it's clear to me that this was just sort of an opportunism. Where there was just...
He warned, basically in classic Trumpian fashion, Russia knew before Congress did. So, you know, and they told the Syrians and the Syrians removed anything that could... there was no point to this at all. Again, whether you agree with it or not, and I haven't been shown the justification for what it would accomplish, even if he'd hit when they weren't ready. So I don't agree with it until somebody shows that to me. And makes the case for why this will improve things and why people who would have died, you know, children and others who would die from chemical attacks will now not. But this is even a step worse than that. This is like just this theater is what it is. It's dropping bombs in places where there aren't anybody. Find part of Montana or Canada where nobody lives and drop some bombs there.
We're going to take these, whatever it is, let's call it $75 to $100 million that we are spending on this attack, and to show Bashar Assad what's what, we're going to eradicate homelessness in half a dozen cities across the country. Take that, buddy.
For example, or that universal health care thing, we're going to use this at least towards beginning that, because that makes no sense. Whatever. You and I will just keep talking around this because I don't think there's anywhere else to go with it, which is, I get the impulse from good liberal people to want to help people. I have that impulse. I've supported interventions before when I've thought they've made sense, when there is a goal that can be achieved and you can save literally people's lives from militias that are mowing them down. But I need to know what that is,
right,
if I'm going to have, to be convinced my country's name and quite frankly my taxpayer money, when I watch all these poor people with their conscience clauses about abortion and birth control, but my money can be spent on blowing people up. I don't get to say no to that.
All right, well, let's I want to play a couple of clips from the media, because I think it's really important that people get why they have to be super vigilant with this stuff. Because, you know, we saw it on CNN after that State of the Union address, or the it wasn't technically a State of the Union address, but a joint session of Congress, I think it was, address. And now we're seeing it again. Here is Fareed Zakaria. I mean, this is there are basically, you know, these are going to be two examples of how the media will turn on a dime when it comes to this stuff. And here is Fareed Zakaria. Remember, he's talking about a missile attack onto an airbase barely used, that was forewarned so that there's really no impact. A completely symbolic gesture which involved Donald Trump saying, do that, or okay, or Jared says, do whatever Jared said to Mattis, or Mattis said to Jared, do that. Here is Fareed Zakaria responding to this.
Fareed, it's day 78 of the Trump presidency. What changed last night?
I think Donald Trump became president of the United States. I think this was actually a big moment because candidate Trump had said that he would never get involved in the Syrian civil war. He told President Obama, you cannot do this without the authorization of Congress. He seemed unconcerned with global norms. President Trump recognized that the President of the United States does have to act to enforce international norms, does have to have this broader moral and political purpose. President Trump realized, as every president has for many decades now, that presidents always believe they have inherent legal authority as commander-in-chief, and they don't need to go to a pesky Congress every time they want military force.
Okay, so...
Yeah, none of that fucking happened.
Okay, well,
let's start with that. None of that.
Well,
I mean, again, like, what the fuck is... I'm sorry, I can't stop myself. What is wrong with these people? And I respect Fareed Zakaria a lot. You know what I mean? As I respected Van Jones when he came out with his stupidity a while back. Oh, he's president now because he gave a good speech or whatever. That, you know, it's like, stop making him president. Stop turning him into something. I remember they did this with George W. Bush, too, and somebody who clearly was 1,000 times more presidential than this guy. But why is this, why is changing this policy from one to the other because your advisors tell you it's the thing to do because your poll numbers are sagging? And let's be honest here, we know that has something to do with it. And you want to look tough. Why does that suddenly make him a president, and why does that suddenly make him more thoughtful? He must have thought this out strategically, unlike, let's say, Medicare, which he said he would never cut and then completely switched positions on. Why is this any different from that?
Well,
what is wrong with, there's something to do with men. I got to tell you, speaking as a man here, where we've got this atavistic caveman thing in us that we see some bombs fly and we look at it like it's shiny jewelry. Ooh, look, the bombs are flying. He must be doing something. I mean, what's the other explanation here for how otherwise intelligent people like Fareed Zakaria become babbling idiots?
I have no idea. And you know, I will say, Michael just IM'd, and he's like, this is the moment that, you know, Fareed Zakaria could have been saying, like, this is the moment that he backtracked on some of the only appealing things he said during the campaign. But the fact is, the man in the past 78 days has ordered a strike in Yemen that killed 8 children plus other people, has killed 200 civilians in Mosul in the biggest civilian death attack that we've had since probably the Iraq war, has expanded...
And the Yemen thing, you've said this before, but important to include this, Sam, which is the previous administration had decided not to do it because it was too risky. He was told by generals not to do it because it was too risky. He didn't listen, and we lost a Navy SEAL. On top of which...
Essentially expanded the parameters in which we are to operate in both Yemen and Somalia to basically throw off the restrictions on what we can do that were put in place to protect and mitigate and limit the number of civilian deaths. So we're going to see a lot more civilian deaths over the course. We certainly saw.
But he doesn't care.
More. But here's my point: is like, why doesn't Fareed Zakaria acknowledge that reality? I mean, why didn't the president become the president when he ordered the deaths of those that involved those 8 civilian Yemeni?
Why didn't he become the president when he came
Why does the guy become the president just when he explodes some bombs?
Right. Well, why didn't he become the president after coming, after saying he was going to give people the best health care? It's going to cover everybody. And then came in and was going to dump 20 million people off of health care. Did that make him president? I mean, the fact that he jumps from one thing to another, depending on who's whispering in his ear with no ideology. He's a man that completely lacks any morality, any character, couldn't give a shit about anybody beyond his basic universe of him, his dumbass son-in-law, his daughter, and the other people that have been granted nepotism to come into his administration and get security clearance. He doesn't, I mean, this is, I just can't stand it. I mean, when somebody proves they're a certain way their whole life, and the entire time they've been running for office and everything they've ever done, they don't suddenly change. But, all right? So just because there are bombs flying and they look shiny and nice and beautiful, as Brian Williams said, doesn't change the fact that based upon your system of judging, this doesn't make him suddenly an intelligent, thoughtful man. But he's the same guy he was a week ago.
Listen, even if it was, I don't care. I mean, even if it was Bernie Sanders, I mean, why in Fareed Zakaria's mind, forget about Donald Trump, forget whoever it would be, why does the person become president at that moment with the knowledge that he has already inflicted military casualties on civilians? What was this moment that he became president to pull this sort of stunt, which really is fundamentally meaningless, and which is one that he laid the groundwork for it to happen in the first place, consciously or not consciously, by basically opening the door to this. I mean, there is an illness in our culture, and it is reflected in our media, or vice versa. I'm not exactly sure.
Again,
where,
dude, I mean, I hate to be. Well, I don't know what it makes me. Am I anti-man? But this is, you don't see women reacting like this. This is a men thing.
I don't know. I saw three of them on the hour that I was on MSNBC reacting more or less that way.
Well, I don't know. I wasn't watching because I don't watch any of that crap anymore. No offense to you, Sam. You're awesome.
I understand.
But you know what? As far as I'm concerned, there are women who purposely, like, make that their deal because they know it goes against brand and makes them, you know, they do better. If you're an Ann Coulter, I'm not sure who you're talking about, so I don't know which women you're talking about. There are women who do that on purpose.
No, I'm talking about, ostensibly, you know, mainstream pontificators and the former Democratic president, of the, presidential nominee. I mean, the Falklands.
But they don't get giggly and excited. I'm saying Hillary Clinton may have come out in favor of it, and I disagree with her, or come out earlier and said, here's what we should do. She didn't call, like, missiles beautiful, though.
Well,
she didn't say that makes
you keep
him
referring
a president.
To this, missiles beautiful.
The point is that there are women that may be in favor of this, but there is something about smart men that make, you know, and I'm giving that, saying that Brian Williams and Fareed Zakaria are smart people, that makes them stupid when it comes to war. When they it's like there's something primitive that we can't get past.
Well, let's, you know, you're referencing it. Let's play this clip now. We have Brian Williams talking to Malcolm Nance, and there is definitely like a Buffy quality to this. The Buffy being that, like,
the vampire slayer?
No, it is. It's a term where cops who run into people who like to buy cop gear and then just like sort of walk around like with black cargo pants.
They all the guys I've run into who are doing the gun stuff who have their own little
there's a buff quality to this. Watch here they are. Here's Brian Williams talking about the missile strike.
Malcolm, I want you to go into greater detail. We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." They are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield.
Wow. I'm hoping Malcolm Nance sits into that stuff because, on foreign policy, often, or at least security policy, I've found him to be very smart.
And I think I just went on and delivered the facts of the situation. I don't think
he didn't get all caught up in it. I mean, just the poetic. I'm surprised again. I think I said this to you earlier. When we talked, so I already ruined my joke. But I'm surprised that Brian Williams didn't tell a tale of how he was riding one of those into town. You know, he was on top of one of those missiles, waving his cowboy hat, man. And then he just came back because Brian Williams does amazing things, boys and girls. What do you say to that? How can somebody have that reaction?
I got a little teary-eyed at just the sheer beauty and the power that those possessed.
Oh, me too.
And I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to claim I didn't get a little bit of a tingle on my leg.
That's right. Like the tingle, that Rich Lowry got when he saw Sarah Palin on TV. Do you remember that tingle that went up his leg? It was that kind of a thing.
There's a lot of tingles.
Knowing Rich Lowry, he probably got a tingle from the bombs, too. Yeah, to find this kind of thing beautiful, I don't know why we're like replacing old lights with LEDs. Maybe we should just light up rooms by launching bombs and missiles. I mean, they'll provide light and they'll be beautiful.
So beautiful.
It's just so stupid. And, I'm shocked, actually, that somebody who's supposed to know better reacts that way. But
all right, well,
again,
here's
that,
you know what?
And just
that's
ridiculous.
Why I wanted to play this stuff, because people should be prepared not to be shocked. People should be prepared to sort of like start to contemplate and to understand how important it is, because we may at this point be, things may have settled down. Congress, and this is the interesting dynamic that I noticed between a Democratic president and a Republican president. Had Hillary Clinton done this, Congress, the Republicans would not have been behind her. Would have been a massive outcry. She would have been constrained in some way. Now,
can you imagine, when they went after Bill Clinton when he launched those to try to hit Bin Laden, and it was all about Monica Lewinsky? If her poll numbers were where Trump's are now,
there would be investigations. There would be investigations.
For whacking the dog.
There would be investigations. Now, fortunately, I think there is an awareness amongst a broad base of the Congress that Donald Trump is a mentally challenged individual. And that, and so there seems to be broad-based calls for him to come to Congress if there's anything further that happens. But of course, and hopefully nothing further. There is no response, essentially, military response from Syria. Although I don't know, what would the logic of their response be at this point, or a response by Russia. And I think to a certain extent, there was a good argument by is it McCall, the former Soviet ambassador?
McFaul.
McFaul, who said, look, Putin probably has reason to be upset about this, too, because he was in the room when the Syrians signed this deal. And
There is that whole conspiracy theory going around. And at this point, it's not as much of a conspiracy theory as it's a theory and you don't have to buy into it. But, which is being that Trump and Putin are buddies, that this was all an exercise in shoring up Trump's flagging poll numbers.
Well, I don't know if it has anything to do with Putin, but
maybe Putin has him do it and says, okay, now you can launch weapons in attack fields that have nobody in them and look tough at home.
I think you don't need Putin in this equation for someone to raise that idea. I mean, they've made goddamn movies about it. This is politics 101, right? I mean, this is what you do.
I'm just saying Putin can benefit from this in ways too. If the worse Trump's numbers get, Congress perhaps falls out of Republican hands, or Trump is, his own people turn on him, or whatever happens, Putin gets more exposed for what things that we all suspect and are pretty sure he actually did when it came to our election. So there's a reason for him to want to keep his guy from crapping out here.
Regardless, I think it's quite possible that it is far more. It seems to me far more plausible that Donald Trump realized I've got basically a very strong potential for a totally failed administration with an increasing chance that the Democrats take over one house of Congress, and God forbid for Trump's purposes that it's the House, because then investigations start in earnest. And I've got to do something quickly to get my poll numbers up. The idea that this shows up and he has the opportunity, and I'm not saying that he contemplated all this, but the idea that somebody in the White House didn't give him this advice seems to stretch the imagination. And so, all right, well, the final point being that people should really be conscious, because under any presidency, the idea of something like this happening, but people should be aware of just how desperate the press is below their confrontation with Trump to normalize this guy so that they can get back to normal things. So that, and the best way to do it is to say that he's gotten presidential every time he ties his shoes, essentially.
And it's like more comfortable world.
Exactly.
Where they can just be sort of relaxed elites and not have to be outraged all the time. It's easier.
It is easier. I mean, listen, you know. I would love it. I mean, you know, in my mind, the I'm hoping that Trump decides, like, I'm just going to support expanding Social Security.
we all hope for these things. That's different than, like, people that are determined for them to happen so much that they'll say they're happening even if they aren't.
You know what I mean?
I mean, that's the difference, is that I would love for Trump to become the best, you know, to become a fantastic president and progressive and smart and all these things. That would be great. And I wouldn't have to say, you know, I don't enjoy being outraged and being annoyed and thinking that my president's an embarrassment and, well, maybe already a war criminal, certainly heading in that direction. But I also will not sugarcoat it if when he proves not to be any of the things I want him to be. The problem with our press is, and you won't either, the problem is our press will, many of them, because they just get tired of being outraged, and it's not their natural way to be.
All right, so let's just briefly talk about the Supreme Court. I mean, this went down like one could have predicted, I don't know, 9 months ago. I'm just thinking.
Just think about if the Democrats, again, I want to say quickly, I know you got to go, but think about if they had completely gotten rid of the filibuster instead of the agreement they came up with, when it became clear that what Republicans, and that really would have been when Obama's administration started. They were bad enough before that, but with how McConnell treated Obama when, you know, I mean, just think about if the Democrats thought of just saying, forget about it. We're not, you know, we're not going to do this, and they eliminated it. And I mean, there's a lot of great policy that could have gotten through, right? There's a public option potentially that could have gotten through. There's cap and trade. There's all sorts of things, but we've sort of allowed this fake impediment that the side and control could get rid of at any time. We've allowed that to stop us from doing all sorts of things that were necessary to do. They ignored it the minute it was inconvenient for them, which is what they were always going to do.
I mean, look, let's just give an overview here. In 2000, I think it was 2003 or 2005, we had the McConnell threatening to pull this act at that time. There was a Gang of Eight that made a deal so that essentially,
I mean, back then Frist was in control, I believe, but McConnell was the whip, and it's the same. Yeah, I mean, he was driving the bus, really.
And so, and then of course we had Harry Reid get rid of the filibuster for lower judges, or I should say judges, federal judges, as opposed to Supreme Court justices and presidential appointees. So now the only thing we have left in terms of the filibuster is legislation. I don't think the Republicans are going to get rid of that anytime soon, frankly. But I do. It would not surprise me that if we ever get to a point, 2 years, 4 years, you know, obviously 2 years not as relevant because you don't have a president to sign it. But if we ever get to a full Democratic control, to see that filibuster gone, because I think at that point there's going to be enough understanding amongst the Democratic politicians that the Republicans, they're off, they are, you know, off the rails. And
I would hope there is this. I think the Democratic coalition has gotten better and better. I mean, the fact that we only lost, you know, three senators on the vote, four on the filibuster, you know, because of Bennett being from Colorado and all that. You think about where we would have expected to be on something like this, even as recently as a couple of years ago. So they're getting, it's getting much better. They're understanding more and more that keeping your part of winning elections and representing your base is also standing up for things you believe in. And so I hope we'll get there. Because again, you know, there's a whole bunch of legislation that we needed that would be helping things right now. Think about if we had a public option. Think about if we had cap and trade. Think about if we had passed background checks.
But here's the thing, though. Here's the thing, Cliff. But here's the thing I worry about. I'm trying to think of, just off the top of my head, and I hadn't contemplated this before. This is something, obviously, I got to do a little work on. But where are we going to get? Well, I guess it's possible. You're talking about three or four more senators. I would say we need, let's say we're going to lose three or four of these senators would not do this if we were in the majority, right? We know the three right there, and then maybe add one or two more.
Right.
Where are we going to get these extra five or six senators in the states that are out there where there's potential that are going to be in blue enough states that they would do this? It's going to be very difficult. It's going to be very difficult.
You're talking about in 18, right?
In 18, in 20, down the road, maybe 22, 24.
Well, 20 things are going to change because there's going to be a lot of seats on the. But you're right, in 18, it's going to be very difficult.
Well, like, what states would they be? Like Pennsylvania, maybe? Would it be like a Wisconsin? Like where?
Wait, you're saying where will we get senators from who'd be willing to support getting rid of the filibuster?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. You're right. I mean, I think that's a difficult thing to, I mean, that again, it goes into the calculation. I'm not talking about what I think, you know, what will definitely happen. These are Democrats, and we always, you know, we always sort of cater to norms that have already been blown up. We don't realize those they've been blown up 5 years later. We sit there and watch the other side do all manner of ridiculous things like the Merrick Garland thing. And then, you know, I mean, again, we had this discussion on this show. Had President Obama looked at that as what it was, which was blowing up norms in an unprecedented way, you know, there's that little maneuver. All I rely on is what, you know, David Waldman says about being able to use that parliamentary trick to get Garland in the court. Whether that is in reality would have worked or not, I don't know. What I do know is he could have used the recess and at least put Garland on for a year. And that's a year of better decisions being made. And we would not do it because, oh, God forbid, we actually go stand up to the people that are wrecking norms by wrecking them ourselves. So you're right. I don't know. Where do those guys come from? Yeah, I mean, maybe they're from Pennsylvania. You just don't know. I mean, look, Sherrod Brown's from Ohio here, and he's still one of the most progressive senators in there.
Right.
You sometimes get people who have the courage, even if they're in swing states or lean Republican states. What everyone wants to say about Claire McCaskill, she still stood up to the Gorsuch thing, and she stood up on background checks and a number of other things where she's been, and where a couple of these other guys, you know, were too wimpy to do it, Heitkamp and others. So it depends on the individual senators. I will just say that the letting minority rule these days will always hurt us, as it does with the Electoral College, as it does with two senators from each of these states, whether it's South Dakota or California. We are hurt much more by that because we are in the majority on virtually everything, and usually we have large majorities, and they're stopping the works. That is what the Republican Party does. And so to assume that they're not going to do this if some legislative proposal, a 10-year enormous tax cut or something, and they've got something like 58 votes for it and they can't quite get to 60, to assume they won't blow it up for that, I wouldn't count on it. Whereas when we took over in 08, after they pulled that nuclear option crap in 05 to make sure they got on like Janice Brown and a bunch of nutcases,
yep,
to get them on the courts who otherwise would never have gotten there. When they did that, our response should have been when we ran everything and had almost 60 senators, and we're going to eventually in 2008, to just get rid of this damn thing because it doesn't help us in the long run. But instead, we'll sit around and we'll always wait till the Republicans breach that norm till we respond. And I just think that's a crazy way to govern. And now what has it gotten us? It's gotten us a guy who's a right-wing nut who seems on regulation to be to the right of Scalia, who is now going to be on the court for 40 years. That's what it's gotten us with Gorsuch.
Cliffy, always a pleasure. On vacation next week, so we will talk in 2 weeks. But happy Pesach if you
you too
if you celebrate. And
I don't celebrate, but I like to think that I do.
Well,
so I still appreciate that.
Happy thinking about Pesach. to you.
There you go.
Sir.
All right. You happy Pesach, and really for everybody else, have a hell of a week.
Talk to you in 2 weeks.
All right, take care.
All right, folks. We will take a break, head into the fun half. A couple of housekeeping notes. One is, if you like coffee and have always wanted to try justcoffee.coop, now is the time. 30% off. Free shipping and 30% off. Use the coupon code MRSPRING17. MR from Majority Report, SPRING for the season that April represents, 17 for the year of our Lord.
Oh, it's very big of you to admit that.
Yeah. I'm saying specifically my Lord.
Oh, yours.
Mine.
You think you have your own personal Lord.
Yeah, and I always refer to me in the royal week.
Ooh,
royal hour.
Someone is definitely not getting enough sleep.
Yeah, I know. I'm exhausted.
Exhausted,
also,
God.
Why
is Ralph shaking me?
Oh, Jesus. Tomorrow, we're very excited to see people who are driving in from, it appears to be, all different parts of the country and even all different parts of the world, like Canada. Very excited to see all our listeners tomorrow. We're going to give you some special stuff to walk away with. Everyone is going to get a lock of Michael's hair.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Why not everybody's?
What?
How about everybody's?
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm just going to shave your head during the show. I didn't tell you about that. Next week we are going on vacation to collectively celebrate Passover. We're going to have five nights of Seders together as a family. Kelly is not here at the moment. She's at a YouTube conference.
She doesn't feel comfortable with all the Jew time.
No, she doesn't. But she's got to attend. We will have new content for you every single day of the week, ladies and gentlemen. And Matt's going to pull some deep archive stuff from the old Majority Report. Fun stuff, right? Yeah, he's convinced. I'm sold. Super
high energy,
super,
Matt.
Super excited about
Sometimes
it.
Sometimes you really are the Jeb Bush of the board. There are times.
And so if you celebrate Passover, happy Passover. If you celebrate Easter, which apparently is coming up, everybody's just like, happy Pesach, happy Pesach. The war on Easter is one of the least recovered wars that we have. And but if you celebrate Easter, then happy Easter, I guess. Hope your bunny comes out of the cave or whatever happens on that day. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. Oh, wait, do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song? Wait, what?
I'll check.
I didn't notice one.
Oh. Yeah, we do. And I
do
think
we?
That this is addressed to me.
Where
I'm
is
gonna
it?
I'm going to need to get this restraining order that people have been inviting.
Wait,
me
when
to
is
get.
It? What's the date of it?
Came in yesterday.
It did?
Yeah.
Okay. Send it to
Sent to Matt.
All right, play the Jimmy Reef Cake song.
I think I know what my answer to the premise of this song is going to be.
Is it about reefer?
I'm sure it's in there.
It's called Debate Me.
Debate Me. Debate Me. Debate Me. What could that mean?
Yes, good afternoon. It's the J-Man here. I like to start out with a clip from Chris Lepaco, the king of earned media.
Get Michael Brooks to debate Jimmy Reefer Cakes. That's up to Michael Brooks, man. I like Michael Brooks. He's a good person. He's funny. And Jimmy Reefer Cakes, I like him too. He's a good guy, and he's funny also.
He says, Jill Stein is the devil. Libertarians are pure evil. Russia, blah, blah, blah. Different tracks. When I sing about legal weed, he doesn't understand the need. I'm trying hard not to insult him back. My Twitter followers see I put out an earnest plea for Michael Brooks to join me in debate. My side, Hillary Clinton sucks, weed should be free, and everything will be great. Join me in the free weed thought experiment. I guarantee that you can prove no detriment. Come on my podcast, debate me. There's no need for you to hate me. I promise that you'll find my debate style's gonna blow your friggin' mind.
Is that it?
That was fantastic.
No, look.
I think that's too. I think you're being too rash. Imagine how much a closed circuit
Jimmy has been between
you two.
Jimmy has been asking for this for years at this point.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
There's just at times there's a little bit of like a level of persistence which gets a little disturbing.
Well, I'll say this. I'm just going to put this out there. If Jimmy Reefercake has a big birthday coming up, I don't know, you know, like a milestone birthday, I'll tell you what would be a great gift by Mrs. That's true. Jimmy Reefercake would be to fly you in to Maine. To a birthday party, to have the debate with Jimmy.
So here's the thing with Jimmy though.
There's a number.
I don't know what
that you would be willing to do
if you give me if for $20,000 all expenses paid, I'll go into Maine and debate.
Or maybe
Jimmy.
You just get paid in weed. Just like 20, like a huge.
That's why
now I can't do that because you put it out on air, you idiot.
Maine, I believe it's decriminalized.
I might be traveling across state lines with it, but no.
You're just going to sell it there.
Just going to go to Bangor.
Yeah, and then you go in.
Just unload a couple of pounds.
Yeah, and that's how you impregnate all the white girls, I think, in Maine is really what you do, according to Governor
LePage. Yeah, but I don't like white girls. But the thing of it is I don't actually know. Jimmy is debating a version of me that exists in his head. Like, I don't actually think weed should be illegal. Like, the only part of me that thinks weed sometimes I've considered maybe there's a serious debate there is after I hear Jimmy's song, sometimes. Then I think we do need, then I'm like, maybe this should be a controlled substance. But I think weed should be illegal. I think Russia's commits human rights violations.
Okay, listen, I just heard Jimmy's song. I don't have to hear your whole backtracking off.
Well, I have a couple of different tracks.
Two tracks, right, exactly. Yeah. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we will take your phone calls and IMs. We have some sound to play in the fun half. Don't forget, it's your membership that makes this show possible. Join themajorityreport.com. If you buy stuff from Amazon or Jet, go to majorityreportkickback.com. We'll be right back after this.